Good morning. I'm happy this morning to introduce our guest speaker, Sosan Flynn, from Clouds and Water Zen Center. Clouds and Water is one of our sister Zen centers. It's located in St. Paul. We've cooperated on a lot of things over the years. One thing we're doing right now is we're cooperating with our youth group, our programming for youth ages 12 to 14. And Sosan has been practicing there for quite a long time. She was ordained in 1992. She received Dharma transmission from Joan Snyder O'Neill, and she is presently transitioning into the position of guiding teacher at Clouds in Water. And there are some other exciting developments at Clouds. They're going to be moving soon into a new building. And thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So this morning I'd like to speak a little bit from an essay by Zen Master Dogen called Only a Buddha and a Buddha. So for those of you who are new, Zen Master Dogen was a monk, a teacher in the 13th century in Japan. And he was the founder of Soto Zen Buddhism, which is the type of Zen Buddhism that is practiced here and at Clouds and Water and at Dharma Field and Compassionate Ocean Zen Center and a lot of places. But those are the four in the Twin Cities. So, of course, the way that we're practicing is a little different than the way that Dogen Zenji was practicing in the 13th century, but that's our heritage. So that's our Dharma heritage. And he was very prolific and did a lot of writing, and his writing also survived. So we're lucky to have his teaching available to us. And this essay in particular, Ken Ford, who's another teacher at Clouds in Water, Ken Ford and I spoke on this essay at Hokyoji Zen Practice Community at a Sesshin, a retreat, in September. And as we were studying it, we thought, well, this is so wonderful, this teaching, and we don't want to limit our reflections on this to such a small group that was there. And so we've been sharing it, and so I'm sharing it with you today. So the first line of this fascicle goes like this. Buddha Dharma cannot be known by a person. For this reason, since olden times, no ordinary person has realized Buddha Dharma. So Buddha Dharma refers to the teachings of the Buddha. So you might wonder, how can this be that Buddha Dharma cannot be known by a person? What are we doing here, if that's true? So my understanding is that a person, or an ordinary person that he's talking about in this line, refers to how we usually think of ourselves. So we usually think of ourselves as an individual person, as someone in control of our own destiny, able to do things under our own power. And even if sometimes we have a little thought of, oh, yes, I know everything is interconnected and I'm only a part of that. So we might have that thought. But still, that I is pretty hard to let go of. So we can say, oh, everything is interconnected and I'm only a part of that. But we still have that ego, that I. Tenshin Reb Anderson Roshi from San Francisco Zen Center, I love the way he talks about this. He says it's as if there's the whole universe, you know, everything, the whole universe, and then there's a little bump on the top. You know, just a little sort of outcropping. That's the I, the ego. That's the sense of a separate self. So even if we have the try to grasp the whole picture, there's still a little sense of a separate self there. And it's that little separate self that cannot know the Buddha Dharma, that cannot realize the Buddha Dharma. So actually, there's a lot of times when we need to have a sense of individuality and a separate self. So it's not like we, you know, disregard that and get rid of it, but just realize that that self cannot know the Buddha Dharma. The next line goes like this. Because it is realized by Buddhas alone, it is said in the Lotus Sutra, only a Buddha and a Buddha can thoroughly master it. So another translation of the Lotus Sutra phrase is, only a Buddha and a Buddha can thoroughly master the suchness of things. So what is thoroughly mastering the suchness of things? It's really something that can't be described, but I'll still try. In order to understand the suchness of things, let me ask you, do you really know your spouse, your child, your parent? Do you really know the food that you had for breakfast this morning? Or the feel of the sun on your face on a warm day? So when I say these things, you might have a sense of yes, but you can't explain what it is. Even if I say, do you really know another individual? Right away you might feel something of your ideas about that person dropping away and have a sense of the possibility of actually encountering someone beyond your ideas about them. And that's the suchness of things. And that's actually beyond what an ordinary person can know. So if you know it like that, in that moment, you're not an ordinary person. In that moment, you're a Buddha. And there's another Buddha. And together, you know the suchness of things. So usually when we first, or when I first heard this phrase of only a Buddha and a Buddha can thoroughly master it, right away my thought was, well, this teaching doesn't apply to me because I'm not a Buddha. So you might have that thought, even after hearing me describe what it could be. You might have a thought of, well, I'll never master it. Or you might have a thought of, okay, if only a Buddha and a Buddha can thoroughly master the suchness of things, then, okay, I'll completely devote myself to practice so that I can become a Buddha in this lifetime. I notice that when I turn this way, it doesn't pick up, so maybe I need to do that. So usually we have these kind of one... There might be more than two, but there's these sort of two main ways of responding. One way, on the one hand, only a Buddha and a Buddha means I'm not in that club, so I'm going to give up. Or only a Buddha and a Buddha means I must become a Buddha and I'm going to devote myself. I would probably rather that you err on the side of devoting yourself. But actually, either choice can be problematic. So, of course, if we give up and say, well, I can never do this, if we decide not to practice, then there's a greater chance we'll remain in ignorance, and there's probably a greater chance we could cause harm to ourselves or others. through our thoughts, deeds, and words. But on the other hand, if we practice devotion to the Buddha way with a lot of ego clinging, that can also cause harm to ourselves and others. If we think, I will become a Buddha, I will endeavor to improve myself, I will attain enlightenment, this is not the Buddha way. So enlightenment isn't something out there that we can achieve. Instead, our practice is to do zazen, sitting practice, and living our life with open, vivid awareness. So, Taigen Dan Layton, who's a teacher in Chicago and a disciple of Tenshin Reb Anderson, he received Dharma transmission from Tenshin Reb Anderson. Anyway, he has a wonderful phrase about zazen. He says, zazen, or sitting meditation, is the ritual enactment of the awakened state. So I just love that. Zazen is the ritual enactment of the awakened state. And I think about what happens when we ritually enact something. So sometimes it seems like nothing happens, right? I mean, we all have experience with, oh, that's just an empty ritual. What's the point of that? That's just empty and there's, I mean, empty in the kind of bad sense, not empty like emptiness. Like, that's useless. That's just meaningless ritual. We might have that thought. But as I understand, Katagiri Roshi used to say a lot, the founder of this place, it's really none of our business how we're doing in our zazen practice. So it's our job to just enact that ritual. It's a ritual enactment of the awakened state. And sometimes in a ritual enactment, it seems useless and it seems like nothing's happening. But the point is to put ourselves in it. The point is to let the activity transform us rather than trying to make transformation happen under our own power. So that's our job in zazen, is to just sit and make our best effort. Can we be present? Can we be open? Can we be awake to this moment? How about this one? Just letting each moment arise and continuing to invite ourselves to be present. That's the ritual enactment of the awakened state. And I think it helps if we can remember that there's no personal salvation. It's never about just you alone. Well, that's one of the reasons why we have Zen centers where people can come and sit together. Of course, if you're sitting at home, you're never really alone. You're still sitting with all beings in the whole universe. But if you come to a Zen center and sit with others, it's really a ritual enactment also of together with the whole universe. It's a way to help us remember that we're not a little bump on the top of the universe. We're completely and profoundly and integral, integrated into the universe. There's also a very interesting thing about this title of the fascicle, Only a Buddha and a Buddha. So, again, from Taigen Dan Layton, he had some interesting information about this phrase. So for those of you who don't know Taigen, he is, not only is he a great Zen teacher, but he's also a great scholar and translator. And he says, well, we know the title as this, Only Buddha and Buddha, but originally in the Sanskrit Lotus Sutra, the title was Only Buddhas Can Thoroughly Know This, or the line that the title is from was Only Buddhas Can Thoroughly Know This. And Kumarajiva, who was a great translator of the sutras to the Chinese, so from Sanskrit to Chinese, when it went there, it was translated by Kumarajiva as Only Buddha and Buddha, or Only Buddha Together with Buddha. And Taigen says that since the appearance of that translation, Buddhist practice in China, Japan, East Asia, and I would say now in the West, has emphasized doing this practice together in relationship. So student and teacher awaken together, or student and teaching awaken together. So I understand that later today here there's going to be a council, which is a circle discussion where you listen from the heart, speak from the heart in a kind of ritualized way. And we do a lot at Clouds and Water. We do a lot of council practice. It's really a way that we can practice together. Sometimes with the profound and sometimes with the mundane. So we've used council practice. We used it in the process of finding a new guiding teacher about 9 years ago. That's when we first started really using it. When our first guiding teacher left and we were really in a lot of distress and didn't know what to do, and so we came together as a community. We had help from a lot of other people, a lot of other centers. And one person who helped us quite a lot was Wendy Nakao Roshi from Los Angeles Zen Center, who came and taught us about council practice. We've also used it for... So we used it in that finding a teacher, and actually the choice of Byakaran Judith Regeer, who's our current guiding teacher, was made in a council where that was going to be the vote. We said everyone who wants to needs to be there. Everyone who wants to have input needs to be there. Of course, we didn't just do that one time. We had, before that, we had lots of discussions. So that's important, too. If you're going to have a council that is going to come to a vote, you have to make sure there's time for everyone to be able to listen to each other. So... As Ted mentioned, now at Clouds and Water, we're looking at moving. We've actually made a purchase offer on a building in St. Paul. It's a little bit west of downtown, but still pretty close to downtown, about a mile and a half from downtown, near the state capitol. So as you can imagine, people have a lot of different ideas about that. You know, just like here, I understand your council is going to be about maybe making some renovations and expansion to this building, which is really exciting, but people have maybe different ideas. So council is a good way to process that. So I know, like for us, you know, I might have my idea like, well, it'd be good to move because, you know, where we are now, we don't even have our own bathrooms. We have to share them with a restaurant and a coffee shop that serves alcohol. And the parking is becoming worse and worse. And our neighbors play a lot of music. So it's hard to sit sometimes. So it's like, to me, I might think, well, obviously we need to move, you know. But someone else might think, I really like where we are now. It's a happening place. Lower Town is getting like more and more. We're having the ballpark come in and now the light rail. And why are we moving at a time when really all the energy is coming into this area? And if I wasn't engaged in Buddhist practice, and if I wasn't listening to them in council practice, like from the heart, I might just immediately... sort of want to have my own idea, like, well, of course I'm right. Of course my idea is right. And I just need to, you know, I might have an idea in a group setting, like, well, my agenda would be to help everyone else see how they're wrong and I'm right. But in counsel practice, it's kind of the opposite. It's like my agenda is to see if I can listen from the heart and really hear what other people are saying. And it doesn't mean that I give up my ideas, but I set them aside while I'm listening. And I don't take it personally if someone disagrees with me, or at least I invite myself not to take it personally. And invite myself to really hear the presence of that person underneath what they're saying. So who they are and their deep feelings and their deep desires and their deep intention, and to take that in. And then even if I still want to talk about my idea, I'm talking about it from a place of really meeting that person where they are. And also I'm talking about it from, hopefully, I'm also entering deeply into my deep intentions and my deep feelings and my fears and whatever's coming up for me. And then if we do that together, that's really a deep and wonderful way to practice together. So I just want to say that and kind of put a plug in for if you were on the fence about whether you're going to attend this council today here, you might want to do it because it's a great way to practice, to bring the practice from sitting quietly to actually being in relationship with others. See if you can do that. It's fun if you can do it. So I thought people might be interested to know, since I'm from another place across the river, a little bit about how we do things at Clouds and Water. And it's really related, I think, to this practicing together. So another thing we do besides councils is we have tried with many of our service positions, like Tenzo, which is the cook, Eno, which is the temple coordinator, Jikido, which is the work coordinator, tried to make those into a group of Buddhas practicing together. So we have three Enos, and they divide up the work. And right now, we're still working on coalescing our Tenzo team, but that's the idea. And for a teaching, we have five teachers we work together we do have a guiding teacher. So Byakran is our guiding teacher, and I will be stepping into that role at the end of January. But the teachers still all meet together once a week. Once a week, we have a two-hour meeting, which is a kind of administrative meeting, but we start out with sort of doing a council where we share individually how we're doing in our practice. And then we talk about, you know, who's leading the session or how we're doing with the forms or, you know, all the nuts and bolts that need to be discussed and decided on. And then on the opposite weeks, we study together. So on those weeks, we just meet for an hour, and we study something together. So I don't know exactly how you do things here, but just kind of looking at, my observation is that there is a working together that's happening here. So I noticed, like, Ben is up teaching the beginner class, and Tim was sick today, so Ted helped me, and so I'm kind of seeing that is happening here as well. So just really wanting to encourage that working together. Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese Zen master, well, not just Vietnamese, he's a teacher for the whole world. He said something like, there's this phrase of... is it Maitreya Buddha, the future Buddha? And he said the future Buddha is Sangha. So the future Buddha is community. Like, that's where that's where the wheel is turning now. It's good to have where sometimes people like a Dogen arises and is a strong teacher, and we can really, you know, be inspired by that. So that happens occasionally. You know, we see Thich Nhat Hanh or, you know, somebody who's really a strong teacher arising. But to see how the community is also the manifestation of Buddha, that's really important. And to find ways to enact that through council, through working together, through the rituals that we might do, like this simple ritual of someone bringing me the podium. Right? So, in a way, it's like the podium could have been up here already, and I could have just moved it into place. And that would have been no big deal. Sometimes, I don't know if you do this here, probably you do during sessions, but sometimes there's a ritual where the leader will go up to the altar and make an offering, and there's always someone called the Jisha that, you know, is by their side, like giving them the incense or giving them the water or whatever it is. And actually, when we were on this retreat at Hokkyoji, there was a new person who said he had practiced somewhere else, and he was just curious because the other place he practiced, he said the doshi, the lead person, just got their own incense. So why do you need someone to bring the incense? And I said, well, I don't really need someone to bring it to me. But that's Buddha and Buddha. So we're ritually enacting Buddha and Buddha through these forms, you know, that together. And also, sometimes people see something like this, see a form like this, and think, oh, that means the teacher's being elevated, like, above everyone, you know, and everyone's bowing down to the teacher, like, bringing the podium and bringing the incense and all of this. And, you know, maybe there's some of that. That could be. That's not necessarily bad, but it's interesting because when I sit on this seat and people are doing that, I receive it as, I need some help. Like, that's a ritual enactment, not of, I'm so great, but like, all these people really need to help me in order for me to do this, which is actually true. Actually, I couldn't be giving this talk. I mean, you're all helping me with it. You might not think you are or see how you are, and I might not always remember that, but when I deeply reflect, it's really true. Sometimes I've had the experience of that happening in a very visceral way, like there was a time at Clouds and Water where during the opening chant, we do an opening chant before the teacher talks, and I was on the teacher seat that day, and this was quite a while ago, like 12 years ago, but anyway, during the opening chant, someone collapsed, and he had a stroke, basically. So someone collapsed, and then, you know, anyway, there were a couple doctors in the congregation, so the ambulance was called, and anyway, so then I'm supposed to give the talk. Or decide what to do. I mean, the guy is still there, you know, laying there. We're waiting for the ambulance. So first I thought, well, we'll just do loving kindness meditation. We'll do a guided meditation and really pray for this person to be well. And also just touch our own suffering and our own fears. So anyway, I did that meditation until the paramedics came and took him away. So, okay, now we're ready for the talk. I just received everyone's energy. I don't really even know how I like looked at my notes and said, well, I'm not talking about that. It's like didn't relate. So I talked about impermanence. But I felt like I was able to do it because of the deep practice, because of everyone meditating together beforehand and everyone's attention right in that moment. So everyone's willingness to be with me right in that moment. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to do it. So sometimes it's really noticeable, right? I mean, in your life, you probably have times when you've really noticed, I only am doing this because others are here and helping me. And it's nice to remember that Actually, it's always like that, even when we don't notice it. Even when we think we're doing things under our own power, it's actually, we aren't. We're all in this together. So let's see. I'm just, well, maybe that's enough. I have more I could say. I mean, this is a long essay, and there's a lot I can talk about, but sometimes less is more. That might be enough. And then I'll stop and see if there's questions or comments, and if there aren't any, I can say other stuff. But it might be more helpful to talk about what you would like to talk about, so I'll open it up. As I sometimes like to say, questions, comments, or rebuttals are accepted.
Thank you very much for your talk and your presence. It's truly appreciated. And as you talk to us, a little voice in my mind said, don't we, whether we practice or we don't practice, we all have these encounters where we feel a real connection to the other person. We can just call that spiritual. And what if we're just happy with that and decide, well, it's given to us, and maybe we don't need to practice. That's pretty bad, I know.
I think that was the question that Dogen was asking as well. Why practice? If we're already Buddha, why practice? So, my experience with that is that when I'm intentionally practicing, it increases the chances of my having encounters like that or opening to someone else's presence. I mean, certainly those things can and do happen to everyone, not just, you know, the Buddhists don't have a bead on that kind of experience, as much as we might like to think we do, you know. So, but, you know, so whether we practice Buddhism or practice something else, if we're engaging in a spiritual practice and inviting ourselves to look deeply at the truth of this life and look deeply at how can we best help living beings, it does increase the chances that we'll be there. That's what I think. But it's still good to keep asking that, you know, so for yourself to just explore it, to say, okay, well, why is it important, or how is it helpful? Not even going with a fixed answer, but just letting the question be there. That might be interesting to play with. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes?
Related to that, I find desire, I feel like if I didn't have, you know, desire is what actually helps me practice. But at the same time, my desire can also be like, get in the way.
Yeah.
This me has such a desire to be me.
Yes.
Sometimes I miss seeing things. So I can relate to that experience where sometimes not practicing is almost in my mind that way. Where you're not trying, not being full of desire, just being.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just
I can't remember what sutra it's from, but there's a sutra that has the line, you should arouse the thought of enlightenment, which I thought is really interesting because it does kind of go against that idea that, you know, it's, oh, you shouldn't have any desires. But actually that desire to practice, I think, is important. But like you said, then to make, you know, to sort of look at, well, am I getting clinging with it? Am I getting rigid and brittle with it? Or am I continuing to open to it and explore it? But I thought, I found that line to be really helpful. You should arouse the thought of enlightenment. And, you know, it sort of also goes against this idea, like I said, well, you can't attain it. Enlightenment isn't a thing that you can attain. Okay, but still, you know, like I said, I would rather people kind of err on the side of devotion to practice than err on the side of not practicing. So again, it's something that to continue to play with. And it's a subtle, and you might see that there's more and more subtle distinctions as you go forward. You know, you can notice more and more subtle clinging. but through that, to continue to be kind to yourself and realize that that's human, actually, to have desires is human. To have a thought of enlightenment or a wish to save all beings or a wish to really open deeply to the truth of this life. That's something precious, so we shouldn't throw that away in our quest to have emptiness. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, continuing off this train, a lot of this practice feels really contrary to my natural inclinations as a person, and practicing selflessness is just contrary to, you know, feeling like a self a lot of the time. And so I think because it's so contrary to our natural urges that we tend to kind of look at it as like training and discipline and a means of attainment.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas your Dan Leighton quote really summarized it perfectly, that it's the practice isn't really a means of transcending life, but it's a celebration of the mystery.
And oh, so, that's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yes.
Thank you. I have a question about when you're meeting another Buddha that either doesn't know that they're a Buddha or they're hostile. How do you stay in touch with their own?
What do you usually do? So it's a challenge. Those, you know, you could kind of see it as, well, this is a Buddha that's really poking at me, that's really encouraging me to look at what are my triggers and, you know, where is my clinging the most evident. So that's one thing that, you know, just sort of shifting the... It's not really about trying to help them see that they're really Buddha. It's more about using the opportunity of, you know, what you can do for yourself. But then also with that is realizing that sometimes your Buddha wisdom might be to say, I can only take this person in small doses. So maybe... I don't meet with them so often if I have the choice. I mean, unless it's someone that you, because of a situation you can't avoid. I mean, even if that were the case, you might decide to, you know, not spend time with a family member, to quit a job or, you know, something like that. Because you have to also nurture yourself. And if you experience that other person as coming at you with a sledgehammer and that you can't practice at all, then that's probably not so good. So it's kind of asking yourself, how can I receive this person as a teaching, you know, as someone who's helping me to see what I need to work on? And then also to ascertain whether maybe it's better to not spend so much time with them because you can only take so much. Is that anything else?
It's helpful. I'm just wondering also about just everyday population of people and just kind of the aggressiveness and the self-centeredness.
Yeah.
That we all kind of walk around in.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. My practice with that is just to see if I can be a calm person, even in the midst of a lot of aggression going around. I find it's actually easier with strangers than it is like with my family. But still, you know, whether it's with strangers or with my family, I might just say, well, I might not be able to change them directly, but if I can at least manifest calm, even if I don't change them directly, I'm still sort of adding to the store of calmness that's present in the world at this moment. So that's kind of how I approach it in my practice. Welcome. Do we have a few more minutes if there's one more? Yes.
What I like to do when there's uncalm people around me is I like to just be like focused on it. Just takes everything that comes to them and just thinks the best of it.
Ah. Yeah. That's good too. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
I'm new to this. A couple of times you used the word invite.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. I'm thinking about I have to make myself do this.
Mm-hmm.
You put it as inviting myself.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, if I'm... And there might be times when it's appropriate to make myself do something. But a lot of times when I use that word or have that thought, it kind of puts me into a rigid place. So if I'm going to make myself do something, even if it's something wholesome, then if I don't do it, then I start applying violence to that I failed. So I'm going to make myself do it. This would be the wholesome thing to do. I didn't do it. Now I'm beating up on myself for not doing it. Whereas if I say I'm going to invite myself to do it, then I don't do it. It's like, well, I didn't take up that invitation that time. Mm-hmm. But I can still invite myself again in the next moment. So I can keep inviting myself. And then I'm kind of watching, and it's also similar to the difficult person thing. It's like, then I'm looking at what can I really do in this situation? So maybe I invite myself to be with the violent, difficult person, and then myself says, no, I can't actually do this right now. And so then that's okay. And then I say, okay, for the best situation now would be for me to, be somewhere else, because if I stay, I'm probably going to cause harm to myself or the other, through my thoughts, actions, or words. I know I'm not the one who came up with the word invite, but I can't remember which teacher I got it from. But anyway, yeah, so that's how I use that. Does that answer your question? One more minute. Yes. Okay, great. Yes, one more. Well, these are quick, so we're ending up having more than.
Uh-huh. And no one would join him. So he said, well, one man does dance. And he told me that.
Ah, yes. He was a one-man band, but even though that was true, the band arguments were still the same. Oh, great. Okay. Well, thank you all so much.
Thank you.